across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Big stories today in Belfast, Australia and Dublin. In Dublin, the big question is, what next for Sinn Féin? They haven't managed, it seems, to change the government in the south. What about changing their leader, Mary Lou McDonald? That's twice she's failed to overturn the government in Dublin. Will she be overturned by her own party? Will she even want to continue? It looks as if she does, but we have a look at what might happen next. Back here in Belfast, Belfast City Council is meeting on Monday night for the last time this year, and on the agenda is the Boyne Bridge near the new Grand Central Station. We've seen all those traffic issues. What about reopening the bridge? There's a move to try to do that, but it's too late. Have a look if you're passing. They're starting to take down the bridge. So what can councillors do? We talk about that. And then we look across at Australia to the jungle. Our very own Dean McCulloch has been kicked out. He's not going to win, but who is? Listen to the show. The Stephen Nolan Show! Right, straight to Dublin, where it looks like Sinn Féin's dream of being in government in Dublin is over for another 5 years at least. With only around a dozen seats still to be filled, it appears to be a case of same again. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are on course to go back into government together. Now, they may need another smaller party, but one thing's for sure, it won't be Sinn Féin. Both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have ruled out a coalition with Mary Lou McDonald's party. So what about her? Where does the party go from here? Does she even want to stay on? What about Piers Doherty, Mark Carthy? What about a new leader? Does Mary Lou McDonald even want to go on herself? Well, she did have a very good election campaign, if not the result that she wanted. Some questions, and it is only some questions, are starting to be asked. Let's try and get some answers. Hugh O'Connell is political editor with the Sunday Times Ireland. Good morning, Hugh.
Good morning, Mark.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, in respect to Sinn Féin, I guess it's interesting. On Saturday, there was definitely a feeling that they had had a good election, that they were on course to potentially get up to 40 seats, maybe even breach the 40 mark. In some quarters, they were even suggesting that Sinn Féin could come out as the largest party. But really, you saw throughout the course of yesterday, I'm looking at places like Dublin Bay South, where Chris Andrews was knocked out by a Social Democrat, a newly elected Social Democrat, TD Owen Hayes. And those kind of constituencies where the party has lost out underscore, I think, the degree to which this is a pretty much a kind of a standstill election for Sinn Féin. And of course, in pure vote share percentage terms, it's dropped quite substantially. It's dropped about 5 points. They've, I think, about 160,000 fewer votes than they got in 2020. So comparing election to election, it's pretty bad. Comparing it to where Sinn Féin in the polls were a year, 18 months ago, it's pretty bad. But comparing it to where Sinn Féin were in the local elections, where they came in with 12%, it's a pretty good result in that context. And it's a pretty good result in the context of what's been a very difficult 12 months for the party. And as you say, Mary Lou McDonald did have a good campaign. And Sinn Féin ran a good campaign. And there are small victories, I think, for the party in terms of the vote management in certain constituencies where they've brought in second seats. I'm thinking of Waterford, I'm thinking of Dublin South Central. These are constituencies where they had ambitious strategies and they paid off. But you know, I'm looking at Carlow Kilkenny as well, where it was thought the party would lose that seat. I'm looking at places like Galway West, Mairead Farrell, it was thought she could lose her seat. And they've had...
Oh, Hugh, it's not a great line. We'll try and fix that. Fortunately, our political editor, Enda McClafferty, is also on the line from Dublin. Morning to you, Enda.
Morning, Mark.
What do you think about Mary Lou McDonald's future?
Well, that's a big question, of course. Now, many within Sinn Féin would say that Mary Lou McDonald was the reason that the party was able to recover so much ground during this campaign. The fact that they started at such a low ebb, as she mentioned there, that 11%, 12% in the local government election was a difficult place to start from. And then we had the challenges, of course, around the controversies leading into the campaign. So Sinn Féin will be pleased that it managed to turn that around in the short term. But the bigger picture is going to be a concern for the party, because you'll remember back in 2020, as you said there, they got over 24%, but they also left a lot of seats in the out there, in a sense, maybe 9 seats. So the performance back then should have been much better. So rather than building on the success of 2020, the party was actually coming into this election trying to recover ground from the local and European elections, which is not a good place to be when you're pitching yourself as the opposition party. And when you consider the external influences, if you like, you're trying to promote the message of change. You're trying to oust a party which has been in government for 14 years. Which you see across Europe and other countries, that has happened. Governments like that have fallen. And at the same time as well, you're saying to the public out there, this is the opposition that you need to be siding with. And it's pretty clear what has happened is that a lot of people out there didn't come out to vote for a start because the turnout was so low at 58%. They weren't energised enough to buy into what the change that Sinn Féin was selling in sufficient numbers. So I think that's the difficulty for the party as to how they manage that process going forward.
And that's the political. What about the personal? You have probably lost count of the number of interviews you've had with Mary Lou McDonald. She's had a tough year in politics and outside politics. Do you think she's up for another 5 years?
Well, that's a good question. Only one person, of course, can answer that question. What I would say is that she's had a tough year, but a good 3 weeks in terms of the campaign. Mm-hmm. But the wider picture, of course, we know there have been difficulties for Mary Lou McDonald, not least the European and local council elections. And then, of course, she struggled to deal with those controversies. She's also had a lot of personal issues in her life as well, which she has documented in a number of interviews. So it has been a challenge for Mary Lou McDonald. Now, whether or not it translates into big questions now being asked about her leadership, that's a different matter, because she still is a big asset for Sinn Féin going forward. I think it's probably more about the strategy that the party will have to adopt now over the course of the next 5 years when it returns to the opposition benches. But as some people down here would suggest, it's now a two-time failure for the party, because it wants to be in government, it wants to affect change, but it simply can't find the vehicle to make that happen. It can't mobilise the vote out there to get people on its side to make that happen. But the other, of course, big question around this is the political landscape in the Republic, because Sinn Féin is now probably at its more accurate base of in and around 19%. We now have three parties, in a sense, in that position at the heart of politics in the Republic of Ireland, and it's difficult to see how that is going to change anytime soon. And I think probably the best that Sinn Féin can hope for is that relationship between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael turns sour at some stage in the future, and that then will open a pathway to power for Sinn Féin. But outside of that, Mark, it's difficult to see how they can now manufacture a position whereby they will be on course for government.
And a thank you. We'll see you on BBC Newsline at lunchtime and at tea time too. That's our political editor, Enda McClafferty. Hugh, hopefully your line is a bit better. Talk us through what happens next in Dublin. Are we still unlikely to see the new government in place before Christmas?
Yeah, I just think from a logistical perspective, it's difficult for the two, for all of the parties to get sign-off from their memberships as they will be expected to. So the last time this process, although it was done during COVID, it did take a couple of weeks, and I suspect it would take that length of time again. And that's after a programme for government is negotiated. And so, I mean, the steps we expect to take place, I think, this week is that the centre-left parties, Labour and the Social Democrats, will at some stage have some discussions about whether or not to form some sort of alliance with which to then have discussions with.
Oh, Hugh, that's not good. That is not good. One of the questions I was going to ask you about was Jerry the Monk Hutch and that extraordinary interview with Paul Reynolds from RTE. We can maybe hear a little bit of it in a moment. But first of all, Hugh, what did you make of Jerry the Monk Hutch nearly getting elected to the Dáil?
I thought it was pretty extraordinary, Mark. He got over 3,000 first preference votes. That's way in excess of what anyone who I was speaking to in Dublin Central at a political level was expecting. Politicians there thought that he would get between 1,000 and 2,000 votes. So the fact he got 3,000 first preferences preference votes and then stayed in the race as long as he did and almost took that fourth seat before being overtaken by Labour's Marie Sherlock is a pretty stunning result for Gerry Hutch. A more stunning result, obviously, would have been his election to the Dáil. But the very fact that he was in the race as long as he was, I think, it shows. And the fact as well that turnout was higher in Dublin Central than it was in the previous election. I think that's the only constituency in the country where turnout has been higher. Enda was referring earlier to the low turnout generally across the country. I think it's a reflection of the disaffection in that constituency with mainstream politics. It's a protest vote. It's a vote for someone who, for better or worse, and many would argue for worse, has established himself in that community over the years.
Oh, Hugh, we keep losing you. We keep losing you. Let's have a quick listen to that interview, that exchange, if you can call it that, yesterday at the count at the RDS between the unsuccessful independent candidate Gerry the Monk Hutch and RTE's crime correspondent Paul Reynolds.
Go away from me, Paul Reynolds. Get paid off the state.
No, I'm just asking.
Get paid off the state and RTE.
The Special Criminal Court found you were in control of the weapons.
You get paid off the state and RTE.
The Special Criminal Court found you were in control of the weapons.
Paul.
No,
you get paid off the state. The state is paying you to say this, Paul.
The Special Criminal Court.
Now, we're going in here to see what results are. Don't mind you what a Special Criminal Court, Paul.
You stood for election, Gerry. Just answer.
My goodness. I tell you what, Paul Reynolds wasn't giving up there, but he didn't get any answers. Nicola Tallant from the Sunday World had a podcast with Gerry Hutch before the election. Good morning, Nicola.
Good morning. And funny, he actually was posed that exact question about the weapons and the Regency, the findings, the judgment of the Special Criminal Court. And he hadn't much to say about it. So, he's obviously had an incredible run at this over the past couple of weeks. Just an extraordinary story, really, to come out of the election. And, you know, I was watching the news last night and I was wondering, is the story that he lost or is the story that he nearly won? Because to me, that's where it's at. And why did this happen? And, you know, who's out there voting for him? Jim Sheridan, the film director who's doing a documentary with him, sort of says it's the lining to what happened in the US. There is this kind of anti-establishment vote, and that seems to be what he got.
Were you surprised he got so many votes? You actually know him, Nicola.
I was surprised the whole way along. Well, first of all, it's been just a crazy kind of a story, really, because first of all, it emerged that he was considering running for election, which seems like a mad story. And that went out, and within days he was in handcuffs in Spain and actually placed in custody because there was a money laundering investigation ongoing over there, and he was picked up. Now, that started the sort of conspiracy theories, you know, is this the establishment wanting to make sure he doesn't run? He got bail in Spain and returned to Dublin. He would be of the opinion, and he spoke about it during the interview, that he's of the conspiracy theory thought. He believes that that investigation was pushed forward to sort of stop him running. That's what he believed. And he said that the arrest sort of made him ever more determined to go for election. So in that short space of time, he managed to run a campaign that clearly, you know, did connect with the people, the voters.
Do you think he'll run again?
No, I don't think he will. I don't think he would have made a very good politician, to be honest with you. I don't know how he would have survived 5 years in the Dáil and, you know, the rules and regulations of being a TD, I suppose. I don't think he'll run again. I think it was a moment in time, and I think it's something maybe as a country we need to reflect on now and start, you know, looking at the reasons why he got so much support.
If you don't mind me saying, Nicola, some may say one of the reasons was you and that podcast, which gave him an international platform. Have you got a bit of flack for that?
I mean, he was a very viable guest to interview for so many reasons. You know, he wasn't just a random criminal to come on, and I don't actually interview criminals on the podcast, but he's standing for election. I mean, to me, the entire Regency Hotel attack, the Kinahan-Hutch feud, is part of our social history now. It changed the face of a lot of things. It was such a significant time in Dublin in particular. And all that happened and what happened is of huge interest to crime correspondents and everybody else. I was very surprised that Gerry Hutch was speaking about that. You know, I had no idea what parameters were going to be around his interview. Was he just going to speak about his political ambition, which really was quite watery because he didn't even seem to have any policies, you know? But when he did start talking about, when you're getting a first-hand account of what happened within that grouping, you know, the story of Gary Hutch's murder in Spain coming from his side of things, obviously there's two sides in that, it was just simply fascinating to hear him talking about that firsthand, those stories that we as journalists repeat and recount from our third-hand places. To hear it coming from the horse's mouth was just fascinating.
The benign analysis of that podcast, and I think it was done in three parts and it was visualised as well, in fairness to you, the benign analysis was that he's changing his ways. Now, many people scoff at that. What do you think?
That he was changing his... Well, I don't know whether you could have said that. He certainly was reluctant to incriminate himself.
No, the very fact that he did it, he's come out from the shadows, literally.
Yeah, I think he did. He came out from the shadows. The fact that he did an interview, I mean, obviously, lots of people have been requesting interviews with him from the minute he walked free from that special criminal court when he was acquitted of the murder charge. He has been inundated with interview requests. He did it because he was standing for election. And, you know, again, like I have my own views what he was doing standing for election. I don't really think deep down he wanted to be probably a politician. I think he was making a show of taking back his city as such. I mean, you have to remember this is such a significant figure. He has been such a significant figure in sort of an organised crime in the city for decades, or certainly seen as that, suspected as that. And he was run out of his town in 2016 in the aftermath of the Regency. He had to remain sort of away from Dublin City. And, you know, I think part of it was coming back, walking the streets, showing, maybe sending out a message to his rivals. That's my opinion. He has certainly not said that to me. And as the podcast showed, we ran the entire interview. We didn't edit it. We didn't cut it. We ran the whole thing to allow people, you know, come to their own conclusions as well.
Okay. Just one final question, Nicola Tallant. We saw a real flash of anger with Paul Reynolds last night on RTE News. How did you find Gerry Hutch face-to-face, one-to-one?
We saw a little bit of a flash of anger from him, which I think, if you go back, is probably in the first of the three parts. And it was when he was being questioned in relation to the Regency Hotel and the judgment of the court, which, you know, was critical, I think, of the DPP and the state for taking a murder charge against him. But a judgment that did pretty much say that he was in charge of those weapons in the aftermath of it, you know, and that, I mean, the judgment in a roundabout way said the state took the wrong charges. You know, there wasn't the evidence to convict him on murder. There would have been evidence maybe to convict him on other charges had they been taken, but they weren't, and the court only had one charge to consider. So he doesn't, yeah, he, there was a flash of anger we saw certainly during the interview when questioned around that. But apart from that, he's articulate, he's fairly charming, he can be funny, you know, he's presenting one side of himself. Clearly there are plenty of other sides to Gerry Hutch.
Nicola Tallant from the Sunday World, thank you very much indeed. Well, we've dealt with the personal as such in terms of what happened to Jerry the Monk Hutch. What about the political? It was a candidate, a Labour candidate called Marie Sherlock, who beat him in the end. Sherlock has the case. I think Ivana Bacik said, the party leader, after Marie Sherlock was declared the winner of the final seat. Standing behind her, if you were watching on the coverage, was the Labour MEP Éoin O'Riordan, who's on the line this morning. A happy man, relieved, I'm sure, Éoin. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Yeah, no, we've had a very good weekend. We look like we're going to win 11 seats. About this time last year, people were speculating about us winning two. And with a number of sort of retirements and my election to the European Parliament, it wasn't necessarily clear how many we would pick up, if any at all. But we came into the election, thankfully, people talking to us now about us, what we're going to win rather than what we're going to lose. And Marie Sherlock's win is a testament to her hard work, really, over the last number of years. She's only ever run once before in a local election 5 years ago. So she's been plugging away in that constituency consistently since then. And her win, is a great testament to that work.
You've got roots on this side of the border. We're looking at what's going to happen next in Dublin closely. Do you think the government's just going to be the status quo?
Well, they're getting very close to the magic number of, 86, 87, some people speculate 90, for it to be, for them not to need anybody else. A smaller party like ours looks at what has just happened to the Green Party, going from 12 to 1. To my eyes, the behaviour of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael towards their coalition partner has been, quite evident and would scare off any individual party going in by themselves with those two bigger ones. It looks like Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, yeah, again, which is almost unique in Europe for a sitting government to be returned. Right across Europe, the opposition has taken up the mantle in the post-COVID era. But only in the Republic have we seen, the same government being returned. It was a low turnout, possibly the lowest ever in the history of the state. A November election is not necessarily going to bring out the masses, particularly when it was a wet day, and people didn't feel the change necessarily was what they felt was on the table, and that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael were going to be returned, and that looks like what's going to happen,
Éoin, I've known you for a long time. Reading between the lines, if your party leader came to you and said, what do you think about going back into government, you seem to be saying no this morning.
Well, the Labour Party is different to other opposition parties in that we've been in government. So, we are a party that has, in our party, ex-ministers, people who have served in government who expect... You joined the Labour Party with an expectation of serving in government. And I would have done that 20 years ago when I joined the Labour Party. So that's your expectation when you join. You don't really get an awful lot of satisfaction from being in opposition because that's not really where anything can be achieved. However, you do have to look at the option to go into government. Can you achieve anything? And on basic, it comes down to numbers. We went in 2011 in the middle of a national crisis as one third of a government. But to go in as one tenth of a government on our own, being the only mudguard, is not something that I think is particularly attractive. But I do think now is the opportunity for people across the island of Ireland who have a centre-left disposition to think about next steps for the centre-left. And within that, I include obviously myself, ourselves, but also, the Green Party, who have a message and have a value system and have an agenda, which is absolutely crucial.
And, would you include Sinn Féin in that, Éoin?
I think what Sinn Féin have to do is to prove to the centre-left. I mean, the conversation is always like, well, would you go in with Sinn Féin? And you've just asked you that question. Sinn Féin have done nothing really to move themselves to a centre-left position. Because in the last 6 months or so, they've moved to the right on immigration, they've moved to the right on climate change, and whenever the test is put to them as to their value system, they always come up short from what we would consider from a centre-left position of being you know, what we would do. And that is something that they have to reflect upon. Because, look, they've had a reasonably good election. They're still very, very far away from being a dominant force in the government.
Mm.
And if they want to have this alignment of the left, as they suggest they will, well, then please stop going to the right on immigration. Please stop playing going to the right on climate change. Please stop playing games with some of these central issues to what we would hold fast and dear in our political party.
Well,
so that's where I would like rather, you know, to have a better realignment of the centre left.
You're not ruling it out, though. You're not
the Greens,
you're not ruling it out,
and the Social Democrats. Well,
one day
I'm not ruling it out. But I mean, we want to be in government. You know, we've been in government with Fine Gael before. We've been in government with Fianna Fáil before. But Sinn Féin, I think, if they're serious about having a government of the left, they need to do an awful lot more work in turning to the left rather than turning to the right.
Always good to hear from you.
Thanks, Mark.
Labour MEP Aoná Ríor Dhon. We asked Sinn Féin to come on to the programme, and there's something that I'm sure they would want to talk about, this claim that they have shifted towards the right in recent months. They will probably deny that, but it would be good to talk to somebody. We'll put the bid in. Good morning again. It's Mark Simpson in the hot seat today. We're going to be talking about the Boyne Bridge in a minute or two. As we know, work to dismantle that bridge near the new Grand Central Station began on Friday. But Belfast City Council is meeting tonight and they're trying to overturn the dismantling. I'm not quite sure how that happens, but let's find out shortly. But first, back to our top story. And what next for Sinn Féin? They haven't managed to change the government, it seems, in Dublin. But is it time, maybe, for them to at least consider changing leader? It's a question I just put to the political commentator and former Sinn Féin election candidate, Chris Donnelly.
I don't think that's something they should rush into necessarily, Mark. I think it was on the cards, given how they plummeted in the polls over the last year, that they weren't going to really upset the balance this time. And even if you look 5 months ago in the local government Euro election, they were there polled under 11-12%. So from their perspective, yes, compared to 2020, it's a poor outcome because they're down just below 20%. However, you know, that's going back 5 years. If you look at where they were 5 months ago, setting it under 12%, to get it now up to where they are today, 19%, to come back really again, what they've managed to do, it's a consolation for them, but it is a significant one. What they've managed to do is confirmed that the electoral landscape in the South has changed fundamentally. I mean, the two parties of government, they're going to be the happiest, obviously, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. But it is remarkable in 2024 that those two parties of government rely on one another to get into power. So we're going to have a Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil coalition, whether it's dependent on a few independents or whether they can lure one or two of the other smaller parties in. But what Sinn Féin's success has been is that those two parties, which historically would have ruled one would have ruled for a period of time, then the other would have ruled for a period of time. Now, to get into power, they need to work together. And that's significant for Sinn Féin. Now, whether Sinn Féin are going to consider changing their party leader, whether Mary Lou McDonald will be, will be face pressure to step aside, I'm not entirely certain. I mean, they reached their high water mark of the mid 30% under Mary Lou McDonald. So rushing to change a leader not necessarily is always going to be the best thing to do.
Suzanne Breen, writing in this morning's Belfast Telegraph, makes the point that even if the party didn't decide to change horse as such and get a new leader at the front of the party, what about her herself? Others wonder, and I quote Suzanne Breen, if McDonald herself truly wants to stay in the job.
That actually would be more of my fear from the perspective of looking at Sinn Féin, that rather than it being the case that there would be a groundswell of opinion to oust Mary Lou McDonald, I think given, you know, she's had a lot of personal difficulties over the last year, it's a slog being a leader of any political party. It's very lonely at the top. And at a moment like this, when you're looking to say, you know, it's going to be another 5 years. I mean, politics is a strange game. Something could happen that could upset the apple cart between a Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael coalition. Of course, if that happens, then the only other party either party could look at to make a new coalition would be Sinn Féin. But, you know, at this moment in time, it's a, really a five-year course. And I'm not entirely certain Mary Lou McDonald would be of a mind to dedicate herself to that. But I think it's more a case that it's her call, at this time at least, than a case of Sinn Féin looking to move beyond Mary Lou McDonald.
What did you make of Jerry the Monk Hutch nearly being elected to the Dáil?
I thought that was pretty extraordinary, the way it seemed to be. I was following the count. It looked like he was in. And then what happened was, I suppose we should have expected it, he didn't do particularly well in the transfers, and Sherlock, the Labour candidate, overtook him. I think what you're seeing there is that alienation that you get often in you know, working class communities, and in the inner city on the north side has faced a lot of challenges. That's where there were the East Wall riots, and you know, I think there's just a lot of disillusionment in certain working class communities, and somebody can be seen as anti-establishment. There's a number of reasons you could give to say why people would look to Jerry Hutch. He also is very well got in the boxing fraternity in that part of the city too. He's been around for a long time. But I think many, many people within Irish politics will breathe a sigh of relief that he didn't succeed in getting elected.
On this side of the border overall, Chris Donnelly, do you think the new government, we know the likely shape of it, is going to make much of a difference to Anglo-Irish relations?
Not really, because it's as you were. It'll be, for the moment at least, Micheál Martin and Simon Harris. There might be some jockeying to see if we go back to a rotating Taoiseach arrangement. I think they will. I think Fine Gael hold an ace card there that, you know, if Fianna Fáil don't agree to it, they could say we're walking away and Fianna Fáil has nowhere else to go. So I think it's going to be an as you were. People know the leaders of both of those parties. The British government, Keir Starmer, has a fledgling, but it is some type of arrangement with them. And up here, we know the face of the Irish government too. I think it's going to be very much as you were and carry on as before. But again, you know, politics is a funny game. You know, 6 months, 12 months ago, Sinn Féin were riding high in the polls in the south. They were pummeled by really the immigration issue and, you know, knocked Dáil low over the summer. They've come back somewhat. Don't know where they're going to be over the next couple of years, but they have established themselves as a lead party. It's one of the three lead parties. There's only a percentage point or two separated Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Sinn Féin. So they're going to be there or thereabouts. They're not going to go away. And that's something also that will continue to impact upon the politics of the North. Because if it is the case that 4 or 5 years down the line, Sinn Féin are back up there 30% plus and they get across the line, well, that's quite a significant moment for relationships north and south in the island and, of course, east-west.
Chris Donnelly, just finally back to Sinn Féin. You will have seen on social media over the weekend some unionists gleefully trying to claim that Sinn Féin have maybe peaked in the south. What do you think?
Well, I think really further to my last point, you know, Sinn Féin had reached the peak of in the mid-30s. Percentage poll support and opinion polls over a year ago. Issues can come along, you can take a hit. That was really what happened with Sinn Féin immigration. But even where they fell, they've fallen to 19%. Now you're going to have, over the next four and a half, five years, a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael coalition. Really, that will have been, I mean, at that point, Fine Gael will have been in power for 18 years consecutively. Fianna Fáil will have been in power for a decade. Now, in any jurisdiction across the land, a weariness sets in with those who are in power. And so long as Sinn Féin continue to be the lead party of opposition, which they undoubtedly will, then it'll be odds on that their support will grow. They will be seen as the alternative voice. And they were knocked off course this time. But I think it would be a fool that would rule out Sinn Féin being in a strong position 4 years down the line to certainly make a pitch to lead the government. So I think it would be foolish for anyone, unionist, nationalist or otherwise, to be ruling Sinn Féin out when they've really, at a low performance from their perspective, nevertheless, they have confirmed themselves as a leading party of opposition and with a very significant mandate of 30, what's probably going to end up just 38, 39, 40 TDs. That's not to be scoffed at.
Chris Donnelly there on Dublin Politics. We'll keep watching that with interest. But back to Belfast politics. And the last full meeting of Belfast City Council for 2024 takes place tonight at 6 o'clock at the Dome of Delight, as Jim McDowell used to call it, City Hall. And on the agenda is the Boyne Bridge. The DUP is calling on fellow councillors to explore options to reopen that bridge. You know the bridge, it's the one near the new Grand Central Station. It closed a couple of weeks ago. The DUP want it reopened, but listen to this, it could be too late. So you can hear it, you can see it as well. We're going to put the pictures out that we took. That was Friday on the Stephen Nolan Twitter feed. And you can hear it. You can hear what's going on. You can see dust rising up. I think reopening the bridge is totally out of the question. In fact, TransLink has just told the Nolan show that the full dismantling of that bridge near Sandy Row is going to be completed by the end of January. That's by the end of next month. So it's not clear exactly what the DUP can achieve tonight, but they're going to try. They've put a council motion forward calling for the bridge to be reopened. On Saturday, several dozen people marched to Belfast City Hall to protest against the demolition. And this evening, some traders in Sandy Row are hoping to have a face-to-face address, look councillors in the eye and say, look what you're doing to us and look what you're doing to our area. We're hopefully going to try and speak to some councillors before the end of the programme, but let's first of all speak to a business owner from the Sandy Row area. Ben Allen owns T.A. Allen Furniture and also operates Allen's Tours. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning. How's it going?
Is it you yourself who is hoping to address the council face-to-face at 6 o'clock tonight?
Yes, I will be there. We have a short time slot in order to hopefully put our point across.
But Ben, it's too late. You're about 4 days too late.
Well, not necessarily. Some of what's being demolished there isn't actually the bridge. It's the old Ulster bus parcel building. So it's not quite got past the point of no return
yet.
Well,
I don't know, Ben. Have a look at the Stephen Nolan X feed. We're going to put it out on social media within minutes. It looks like the bridge to me.
Right. Well, never say never. Our biggest problem at the moment isn't actually whether the bridge is getting pulled down or not. Obviously, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. The biggest problem at the moment is that we have no passing trade at all in Sandy Row anymore.
Well, you can't reopen the bridge if they're starting to take it down. What can you get then?
Well, first of all, we could do with maybe some rates relief, like what happened during COVID, because all the business people here were paying city centre rates. We've no trade whatsoever. Myrtle Sweet Shop, that has been mentioned by your colleague many times on his show, has just announced that they're closing down.
What?
Yes, after so many years in business, they have no trade because of what's happened. They just shut the bottom of the road off. No trade can get up or down, or if there is any traffic, it just turns into a logjam. The whole of Belfast city centre has been turned into a traffic mayhem.
We know that, Ben, but tell us about this sweet shop. What are you hearing?
Well, it was announced on Facebook on Saturday that after about 6 weeks now of zero trade, they can't afford to go on.
Surely not zero trade.
Zero trade? Well, nobody can come across the Boyne Bridge. Even the local bakeries and food shops, they did get some trade out of the building work, you know, as the builders come over. But the builders can't get over anymore.
But there are people living nearby and there are other roads. I mean, you can get in via Bradbury Place there.
Well, can you really? If the traffic's completely log-jammed? The whole thing has been so badly planned out. There was no information given as to what may happen or looked into. Really, TransLink didn't care. They're only worried about the big new train station.
No, well, they say in their statement that they've had strong community engagement. I don't know if they spoke to you, but they say they have talked to hundreds of people.
I was at some of the meetings, and as a coach operator, I asked at one of the meetings just 6 months ago, says, "This is your lovely new train station, brilliant. I want to drop a crowd of pensioners down to go on the train to Dublin. Where do I drop them?" "Well, you can't drop them at the train station. You have to drop them outside the Europa Hotel." This is the sort of planning. Let's put in, there's nowhere, if you bring your elderly relative or neighbour down to drop them at the train station, there's a team of traffic wardens there making sure you don't stop. The whole planning of this whole thing has been a total joke.
Ben, bear with me. Can I explain that? I'm not a spokesperson for Translink, but I've covered this story so often that they think they should rename the train station Belfast Grand Simpson Station. So, bear with me. So, the reason that they are knocking down the bridge is to allow them to build a drop-off area. You're absolutely right. There are no laybys. It's very, very difficult to drop anyone off outside the station, which is a fundamental, isn't it? I'd agree with you there, for any transport hub. But the reason they're taking down the bridge is to smooth out that road and allow them to build a lay-by area. So I suppose what Translink are saying to you, it would be great if they came on and we're on for another 45 minutes, or maybe they can come on tomorrow whenever they've had a bit more time to think about this. What they're saying is, Ben, we signalled this, if you pardon the transport pun, long in advance. They got planning permission before COVID. This, everybody should have known, was going to happen. And by this time next year, it'll all be there and you'll get your drop-off area.
Well, the plans that I saw don't include the drop-off area substantial enough for such a large station. Let's follow the money. Why do they want the bridge down? Well, the old bus station currently only has one access point, and that's through Glengall Street. Take the bridge down, open it up in the big square. All of a sudden, that land becomes very valuable. And the plans are there for all the multi-storey buildings to go in, all that sort of thing. The bridge has to go in order to make the old bus station worth anything. That's the real reason the bridge is coming down.
What's wrong with that?
Well, that would be fine, you know, if you weren't destroying not only a local business community, but the people that live in Sandy Row as well. It's not just Sandy Row. I heard comments from people on the Grosvenor Road where, you know, they promised all these new paving stones, you know, like in the city centre, the Street to Head project. Well, the one on Sandy Row only comes up as far as the Gilpins, where Gilpins used to be. There will be no shops there by the time those are built.
And tell us about your own situation, Ben. How badly has your business been hit?
Well, at the moment, we've just basically closed the furniture end of things. When it comes to the tours, people are arriving. You know, we have a set time we leave at. People are arriving 15, 20 minutes late to go on a day trip because of the traffic situation. You know, the taxis or their Ubers can't get to us in the time that they thought it would take. So we're missing customers there. The whole place is just a ghost town, you know. And we're still paying city centre rates. It's madness.
So is that going to be your pitch tonight? Reduce our rates?
The main pitch is, really, if you think about it, in this lovely country that we live in, we should be building bridges, not ripping them down.
Do you mean metaphorically?
In every aspect.
Like, I shouldn't laugh, Ben, because, you know, this is your livelihood. And if that's true about the sweet shop, you know, people must be very, very, very disappointed and maybe worried, you know, especially in the run-up to Christmas.
Exactly. There'll be more to come, honestly. Walk up, have a look around the place. It's amazing, actually, how closing one road has caused so much mayhem. And not just in that area, right across the whole city.
OK, well, stay with us, Ben, because John Anderson is on the line from the Ulster Architectural Heritage Society. John, good morning to you. You've taken the Department for Infrastructure to court and Translink to court once. Would you now consider doing it again?
Morning, Mark. Our legal representatives wrote to the DFI Minister, John O'Dowd, on Friday, asking him to urgently stop this work. Because, I mean, this situation has got more and more bizarre. You know, we now have departmental corporate vandalism destroying one of the last railway heritage assets in central Belfast. But that almost has become a side issue.
John, sorry to interrupt. Just to confirm, because I sent you the video. You've had a chance to look at the video. Does that look like proper dismantling to you?
Absolutely not. It is. It's
oh, sorry, I don't mean proper. I mean the work has started.
Well, the word that we were promised in the court case, and I think you were sitting in the court case, in the public gallery. The word we were promised was sensitive dismantling.
But sorry, John, I don't know if you heard at the start of the programme, there was a little bit of doubt whether this was just preparatory works or demolition. This looked to me like demolition. What did it look to you like?
It is. It's wrecking. But the bizarre thing about this is DFI, or the Planning Authority, TransLink are doing this, and they're both operating in breach of planning conditions. They're breaching the planning conditions, which means they're breaching the law.
Very serious because allegation. Be specific, please, John, and we will put this to TransLink and to the department.
Planning condition number 8 and 11, but 8 is the one we are concerned with, says that no works to Durham Street, which is the bridge, can take place until a full traffic mitigation programme is in place. Now, as Mr. Allen said, you only have to look at central Belfast at the moment. It is a total disaster.
It doesn't mean there isn't a programme in place to try and mitigate the traffic congestion.
It's maybe just not working. No, it does. Well, that was a stipulation in the planning condition, that it has to work. And the planning condition is not met. It is still out to consultation with DFI Roads, and DFI Roads basically kicked it into touch because it wasn't anywhere near adequate. And as you see, the congestion in central Belfast is crazy. And it's mostly down to the fact that the bridge is shut. Now, it's a betrayal of trust of the local community. It's a betrayal of trust of the traders. It's a betrayal of trust, actually, of passengers to the station who could have walked directly from Great Victoria Street under the bridge, now that the bridge is no longer used for buses and trains, under the bridge and directly into the station, the shortest, safest way. But as Mr. Allen said, there are other motives here, and John, it's all to do with property development.
John Anderson, some might label you Johnny Come Lately. This was all signalled long before COVID, long before work started, and you've only rushed in Johnny Come Lately at the last minute, screaming and shouting about it.
No, not at all. We've been at this for years. And as I say, we were made promises by the DFI barrister and by the TransLink barrister. Those promises have been broken. Now, there are serious questions for the minister here, because the ministerial code says that the minister must uphold the law without fear or favour. Now, what is going on here? This is all going on without planning permission. It's been going on since the 18th or thereabouts, when TransLink cut the trees down. It's a process of intimidating both the public, us as a small heritage charity, and the traders into thinking, oh, it's too late, this is going ahead. It has ruined confidence in the planning process, because we have actually a planning authority here that is permitting this, and a minister who is permitting his department to do this. What's going on here?
John O'Dowd isn't here to defend himself. We will ask the department. Those are very serious charges. Some might say, John, it's, you're talking about two of the biggest organisations, public organisations in Belfast, TransLink and the Department for Infrastructure. Would they really be flagrantly breaching planning law? Many will doubt it, but we'll let them speak for themselves. I do have a TransLink statement in front of me. Planning permission was granted by the department in March 2019, about a year before COVID, which included the removal of Durham Street and the Boyne Bridge. Enabling work to begin the dismantling of the process has been underway for a number of weeks. The dismantling of the bridge is expected to be completed in January. And the statement goes on to say they have consulted about this extensively in terms of the depth and the breadth of their consultation. Stay with us, John. Brian is on the line from Inniskillen. Hello, Brian.
Good morning, Mark. Good to hear from you.
What do you think about this bridge 70 miles up the road from you?
Well, I took the brave step yesterday and came along past it. But I thought I'd send a few quid up to Belfast for a pre-Christmas shopping, which went well. Look, there's two points to this. I'll go on to the bridge in a moment. We do need, and I've said it to local MLAs here, we need a complete upheaval of how our planning laws are regulated here. And one that I would call for changing is business evaporation of rates when anything in the local area is established in infrastructure changes that causes defects to turn over, right? That's that bagged and tagged. So that's something I'm pushing for. The bridge, get it down. get this place moved on. I go to major cities from time to time in the past, and I stand with my jaw open at train stations and the fantastic open areas that they have and the progression forward. But what we have here is a mixture of, I don't want to insult anybody, but I do see this as a pattern in Northern Ireland. We have a middle-class dinosaur here, and then we also have different political parties that, for political reasons, also by default, almost don't want progression in the city because of the so-called history of the bridge.
Brian, that's a serious charge. Who are you calling a middle-class dinosaur?
People, in my opinion, from political parties that want the bridge to stay, they're going at it on a political agenda, their middle-class agenda. They're done, they're toast, they're dinosaurs. Move it on. Let the younger generations, my children's age approaching 30, let's say, want a diverse city. We don't want dinosauric monuments to the past, just to please older people who will be gone in no time. And really and truly, the truth be told, we need to modernise this city and we need to get the job done and we need to stop listening to this middle-class jamboree that goes on again and again and again.
Try telling that, Brian, to that sweet shop that looks as if it's going to have to close down after many, many years.
Yeah, well, the point I made at the beginning, this is why we need a complete oversight of how planning operates and joins these jigsaws together. So it's two different points that I've made in two different questions. I think I've answered both of them.
Brian, thank you. Keep in touch with us. Greg, what do you think?
Hello, yes. I'd just like to say, I think the whole thing's absolutely crazy. I didn't realise when they're knocking this bridge down, which has caused so much traffic disruption, as well as you can't turn on to the Gravener Road when you go along Victoria Street, all for the station. I didn't realise when they knock this bridge down, they're actually going to put a road back in, which is absolute nuts. I don't think a lot of people realise. Instead of just landscaping below the bridge for an exit into the entrance into the new station from the old station, would have been done quicker, and all them businesses too in the old bus station, how are they surviving? The whole thing is nuts and the traffic is just chaos over that bridge, because that was a main arterial route for people using it, and I know it was always busy, but it's crazy now, and the Translink just don't seem to listen to anyone. The arrogance is unbelievable.
Well, Greg, they have been on the show recently, and hopefully they'll be on, if not today, tomorrow. Thanks for calling in. Do keep the calls coming in. Ben Allen, the business owner from Sandy Row, is still with us.
Yeah.
Ben, what do you make of what you've just heard from our callers?
Well, there's a lot of good points there, although I'm really interested in what Brian's saying there, now that Sandy Row is now a middle-class area. Does that mean our property prices have gone up?
So you're more offended at that, John? Are you more offended at being called middle class or a dinosaur?
Well, I don't know. I spent a lot of my time in overalls with dirty hands. So, but this, unfortunately, there's a touch of an attitude there. If I can come back on that,
very quickly, John, we have a minute left.
There's very little respect for built heritage in Northern Ireland. And built heritage, it's not about nostalgia. It's about a profitable future for this country. If you effectively do a character assassination on a country so there's nothing left in it but bland tar blocks, who wants to come here? Who wants to come and work here? You know, this is a very valid point. And unfortunately, Stormont don't get it.
John, were people really coming to look at the Boyne Bridge, coming to Belfast?
The Boyne Bridge, 1641 bridge, 1863 bridge, 1936 bridge. The entire history of the development of Belfast is embodied in that bridge. And there is more engineering technology in that bridge than there ever will be in the Titanic Museum or in the projected Belfast stories.
Okay. John Anderson, thank you. All eyes on Belfast City Council at 6 o'clock tonight. You know what? I think I may even go along myself. Irish language and bilingual street signs in Northern Ireland are costing the taxpayer a lot of money because a lot of them are being damaged. In fact, somebody was pointing out this morning, it happens on both sides of the border, doesn't it? You know, in some places, the Irish is scored out. In other places, the English is scored out. Brendan Hughes, our political reporter, has been doing some research into this. And he found out, and wait for it, folks, in the past 5 years, more than 300 street signs have been vandalised. And that's costing councils here, including Belfast, 60 £6,000 in repairs and replacements, almost. Now, most of the incidents have been in Mid-Ulster, but Fermanagh and Omagh District had 74 incidents, while Belfast City Council had 23. Let's talk to the TUV councillor, Ron McDowell, and also the SDLP MLA, Patsy McGlone. Good morning to you both. Patsy, I'll start with you. Is it a price worth paying, replacing and repairing all of these signs?
Well, I think criminal activity in any instance that leads to this sort of thing has to be roundly condemned. It's really, I've no doubt that there's a very, very small number of people indulging in this criminal activity. And all I say is just take a look at themselves. Take a look around them. The language that they are seeing written on those signs is the very language that whenever they speak about their local townland names, whether that's Coch, whether it's Ballinderry, whether that's Drumminard, whether that's Duloup, whether it's Ballyronan, those are exactly derivatives from the very language that they are defacing. Now, for me, any language is a window to understanding, as a window to understanding other people's culture, other people, where they're coming from. And indeed, I was very fortunate, and I was reflecting on it there this morning. Many years ago, I went to the Rooney in Marfelta and I learned Latin. It was probably one of the best languages that I learned because it has opened understanding to so, so many other languages and cultures and been so helpful in dealing with people whenever people have different languages. So for me, any language is a window to understanding of another culture, of another community. Particularly for Irish, it's my own language, it's the language of my country, it's the language that my ancestors spoke, and it's good and it's important to keep that language alive.
We'll be getting texts from listeners under 30 asking us, Patsy, what is Latin? What is Latin?
Indeed, Mark, indeed, but it is very, very helpful, I have to say.
And Patsy, anecdotally, you're driving around the country, driving around the island. Do you see this happening more and more or not? And as I say, it happens on both sides of the border.
Not particularly more and more. It's just it attracts a lot of attention.
It does.
And I suppose maybe in areas where there haven't been bilingual signs before, people have noticed them, including those who indulge in this criminal activity. And for whatever reason, whether it's hatred, whether it's bias, whether it's lack of understanding, they just go out and deface them, which is pretty stupid, because all they're doing is adding to the ratepayers' bills and making the place look poorer and making it look bad. And it isn't reflective of what the rest of the community, irrespective of where they're coming from, is. And so I know that for a fact because I've represented the area for many years now, that people just want to get on with one another, want to live in respect for one another and respect for each other's cultures and identities.
Ron McDowell, what do you think?
I think Patsy and I would agree on the first instance that any criminal damage is to be condemned. It leads to a criminal record and it leads to circumstances that will affect you in your daily life. But I have to say that a lot of the intolerance and a lot of the debate around Irish language and dual language policy comes from what is essentially bad government and bad policies. You think of Belfast and the 15% that's required, the 15% threshold to erect dual language street signage for what is essentially a cultural statement. There's no need to speak Irish in today's society. It's a cultural statement. And on a previous occasion, speaking on the Nolan Show with Linda Irvine said she wouldn't be in favour of the Irish language being put where it wasn't wanted. And what we have is the Irish language being put where it's not wanted. And unfortunately, as a result of that, I can only see these attacks continuing into the near future.
Patsy?
Well, I have to say that, first of all, this is about respect. And it's respect for identity. And it's respect for each other's identity. I have to say that, Ron. That's where I'm coming from. Now, specifically in Mid-Ulster, where you have these road signs, 50 plus 1% of people who have returned their responses whenever they're asked about these, that's what the council accepts as policy to put up a road sign. So a very area, but nevertheless, it is an acceptance of difference. It's an acceptance of my culture, your culture, and that's the way I look at it. I'm a fluent Irish speaker and proud to be, and I just expect people and anticipate that people will respect that just in the same way as I would respect where they're coming from.
Ron McDowell?
I would have to say the Irish language is a heritage item. I had spoken to Brendan Hughes after he'd done the article on the vandalism, and I met him in Clifton Street Orange Hall where we discussed some of the champions of the Irish language who came from that Orange Hall.
Absolutely.
But one of the things I would say is that the European Charter for Regional and Minority Languages respects the identity and the cultural heritage of people who dwell in their own community. The people who dwell in vast swathes of Northern Ireland do not class themselves as being Irish. They don't have an Irish identity. They have a strong Ulster British tradition and identity. And under that European Charter for Regional or Minority Languages, they are protected from assimilation. And assimilation means the removal of their identity. So huge swathes of the country that are now getting Irish street signs, that are now getting an Irish identity foisted upon them, do not identify with that language or that heritage. And when you have a threshold as low as 15%, then it does become a foreign language in the area, and there is kickback against it. And again, it comes from bad policy. Just because in certain councils around the country there is a majority of nationalist or perhaps liberal councillors who can vote these things through, just because they can doesn't mean they should. Okay. They should respect all the communities in the areas that they represent.
Patsy, last word from you then. I want to ask Ronald McDonald by Boyne Bridge.
Yeah, well, we'll have to come back and say there, this isn't about assimilation. And Ron, maybe you need to go back and look what the assimilation means. This is accommodation. This is accommodation of two languages. Assimilation is something quite different. It means that you obscure or remove one identity. That's simply not it. From my point of view, I want to accommodate other people's identity, but in return for that, I expect and anticipate that my identity and many others who aren't even from a nationalist background who speak Irish will have that respect accorded to their ability to use the language and to want to use the language in a respectful way.
Patsy, thank you very much indeed. I think it's a sitting day at the Assembly. Are you way up there now?
I'm just sitting outside here waiting to go in, so indeed, Mark. Okay.
Give everyone my regards up on the hill. I'm going to be at the Dome of Delight tonight. Ron McDowell, are you going to join me at Belfast City Council? And what do you expect to happen over the Boyne Bridge?
I'm very disappointed, very worrying developments today on the Boyne Bridge. It looks like the diggers are in place, and it looks like there may be a move to the demolition of that bridge today. And I have to say, from the inception of the plans to take down the Boyne Bridge, it has been an open sore. A main arterial route into the centre of town, an artery which comes from
So what's going to happen tonight, Ron? Sorry to interrupt.
So there's going to be a motion put before Belfast City Council about trying to stimulate those areas of Sandy Road which are now hurting, 50% loss of trade, and there's going to be a debate on the Boyne Bridge and the alternatives and what we can do to stimulate Sandy Row in the next coming days, because it's hurting and there's traffic logjam across the city and it's a big debate.
So even though you're a big I'm a Celebrity fan, you're going to Belfast City Council tonight instead?
I am, and I have an 18-year-old daughter who's going to keep me up to all the latest developments on a live news feed straight into the chamber.
Ron McDowell, Patsy McGlone, thank you both very much indeed. Let's take a quick call on this actually before we go. Fred's in Dromore. Fred, quick word on this.
Hello. No, there's all this. We're back to the old stories again.
Street signs.
Street signs and Irish language and all this. But during the whole election campaign in the Republic of Ireland, did we hear one, even Sinn Féin, not saying their bit in Irish? We didn't hear Irish mentioned once. No one spoke in Irish, and the people complaining about it don't speak Irish.
Well, in fairness, I go to news conferences, and what you see in the news isn't always what is actually said at the news conference. So people may have been speaking in Irish, but they just didn't show it on mainstream, if I can call it like that, RTE. TG Carraher maybe covered it. So I'm not sure that's entirely true, Fred. But thank you. Keep listening. Keep watching. Teresa, what's your quick point about street signs?
Well, Mark, you talk about Ulster Scots, wasting money in it. That's only a dialogue. It's not a language of a country.
Everybody's opening these cans of worms,
yes.
But thank you for listening, Teresa. I want to talk before we go about two things. You always get light and shade on the Nolan programme. We want to talk about I'm a Celebrity, but we want to also talk about that huge news last Friday. I'm sure you saw it, the House of Commons voting in favour of assisted dying in England and Wales. This is how the vote went.
The ayes to the right, 330. The noes to the left, 275. The ayes have it, the ayes have it. And look! Right, does the member in charge of the bill wish to move the motion number two, Kim Levitt?
Mr Speaker, I move that the Public Bill Committee, to which the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill stands committed, shall have the power to send for persons, papers and records.
Well, that's it then. It's coming, if all goes according to plan, for the supporters of this bill, assisted dying. The legislation could be passed by next summer. The first person to avail of this new system could take their own life within the next 2 years. It only applies to England and Wales, but we've seen it with other issues that are voted through in the House of Commons by MPs. Eventually, sometimes, they reach this part of the world as well. Let's talk to Gavin Walker, who was in favour of this vote on Friday. He's chair of the campaign group My Death, My Decision. And also Peter Linus from the Evangelical Alliance. Peter Linus, good morning to you. Can I start with you? We spoke on Good Morning Ulster on Friday, and I put the hypothetical question to you. What would you do if this vote was passed? It now has passed. Are you going to keep protesting?
Well, we're going to keep engaging and advocating, Mark. We are disappointed by the vote. I have to say I felt a real heaviness on Friday. It was a good debate. It was respectful. It was deeply engaged. There was only one Northern Ireland MP who voted in favour of the bill, Colm Eastwood. So I think that was encouraging from a local perspective. It was relatively close. I appreciate it. 330 to 275, as your clip said. But already the papers have been clear. The Independent had a very good article at the weekend that at least 36 of those voting and possibly slightly more were offering what they call conditional support. So they said they could change their minds once they saw the bill under scrutiny. And quite a lot were public about that. And that's what that's based on. People said, we're going to vote. And Kim Leadbeater said to them, if you're up for continuing the conversation, vote it through and then we'll see where we get to. Because I think there's an acknowledgement the safeguards aren't ideal. This isn't particularly well drafted and changes will have to occur. So yes, a vote has occurred, but we will continue to campaign because at least those 36 to 40 MPs have already said they're not totally convinced yet. And so they may not be when we look at all the kind of problems and flaws in the bill. And I still think there are a number. And I think even the supporters acknowledge that. So, and the House of Lords could vote it down and it's got to go to committee. It's got a process to go through. So I think rightly we'll all continue to campaign and advocate around this to make sure either it doesn't pass or we get a better bill than the one that's currently there.
That's the political, Peter. What about the personal? You hinted at it there about how you felt personally when you heard that announcement. Yeah. Tell us a bit more.
I did feel it was a heavy day on Friday. I felt a kind of real weight and heaviness. Look, Mark, my own dad got a terminal diagnosis of a brain tumour a number of years ago. We nursed him through that. My mother-in-law, similarly, was probably slightly longer. Each of those were different in terms of our engagement. This isn't just a hypothetical to me. I understand what it looks like. The idea of a doctor coming in and saying, so what about, you know, ending your dad's life? What about him taking something? What about it? Just changes the conversation. It changes it. We're in a position to be able to engage well on that. There are many people for whom that pressure would come, the cost of care, the cost of support. And I am concerned. Look, only a third of palliative care in the UK is funded by government. Two thirds isn't. But this service, this bill guarantees, will be funded. And I am deeply concerned where it goes. So I felt a real heaviness on Friday. It was a respectful debate. But you saw in the House, it was silent when that vote was read out. And rightly, but you could sense the weight for everybody, no matter your views. And Gavin and I disagree, but I think probably we both feel.
Yes.
That was a good debate, but that was a heavy moment in the House because this has massive implications.
The detail is important, Peter. Before I go to Gavin, under this legislation, a doctor would never suggest assisted dying. It would have to come from the patient themselves.
Well, I don't think that isn't that clear from the bill what the doctor can and can't be, what can and can't be said in those conversations. So it can come from the doctor first. Okay. The bill is saying that the doctor, and that is an open, because it's likely there'll be a service offered around this. That's kind of a bit of a detail, but the thing is, it enters all conversation. But I'll check while you're talking to Gavin, but my understanding is that the doctor can suggest that in the bill.
Gavin Walker, what is your take on that particular issue before we look at the big picture?
Mark, thank you. I think actually Peter is right. The doctor can bring that conversation up, but there's a process of actually explaining to a patient what all of their options might be, from taking treatment to having a DNR to having assisted death. So the conversation will be fairly rounded and it can include everything. I think Peter is quite right. The debate on Friday was impressive in that it gave time to air all of the issues from both sides of the debate. It was a very respectful debate. It's one now I hope that we can transfer to Northern Ireland and have over here. Because now that of course, that's happened in Westminster, all of the jurisdictions in the United Kingdom are having this discussion, with the exception of Northern Ireland. So hopefully we can learn from what was happening over there, bring that debate over to Northern Ireland and continue it from there. There's a lot to be said about it. There's a lot of things to look at. I know there are still some concerns around the bill, but I think it would be very worthwhile to have that discussion here and allow the people of Northern Ireland to have their say. Because at this point, we are the only people in the United Kingdom who aren't able to talk about an assisted dying legislation being introduced in our jurisdiction.
Let me ask you the personal question too. How did you feel on Friday afternoon when you heard the vote?
Well, I felt that it was a big step forward for the people of England and Wales. I think it was something that people have put a lot of time and effort into. I'd spoken to a lot of MPs in advance of the vote itself, so I can assure your listeners that people, that MPs did come to the debate having done a lot of research and spent a lot of hours talking to all kinds of people. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to convince some of our MPs, but nevertheless, they were open to discussion, and that was very encouraging.
And Peter makes the point, only one of our MPs actually voted in favour of this. That suggests this legislation isn't coming anywhere near Stormont anytime soon.
If that were the case, Mark, I'd be very disappointed, and I think most of the people in Northern Ireland would feel the same way. You know, in the poll that we did in August, I keep referring to, 65% of the people in Northern Ireland feel that we should have assisted dying legislation here. So, if nothing else, we should certainly have the respect to have the conversation about that and to have a political engagement with it. And it just can't be ignored any longer. And I think the politicians here, our local politicians, need to find the mechanism that would allow us to have that conversation. I think a citizens' assembly is the best way to do that, because it takes it a little bit out of the political arena, puts it back in the public area. We can talk about what we would like, and then we can tell our MLAs what we'd like, that we'd like them to take that forward.
Back to the detail with Peter. You were right. A doctor can suggest it.
Yes. But that's part of the, we need to get into the detail of this bill. And of course, this is only a proposed bill. So these are some of the safeguards that need to be looked at. Many doctors not happy about that, or that they would have to refer somebody. So yes, these are some of the steps. And in terms of Northern Ireland, I think it is worth, we have to note that only one MP voted in favour of it. That is important. I don't think a citizens' assembly is a wise way to go. We have an assembly. They have lots of pressing concerns. Let's see what happens in England and Wales. Look, I'm against this in principle. I've been clear on that. But I also think we don't have the time and the capacity to go there. And the citizens' assembly is certainly not the way to do it. And the political appetite simply isn't here. And of course, polling, we all do polling, and we all know how to frame questions in ways that get a better result for us. Once we get into the details of the bill at every stage, people get less and less convinced when they understand it's assisted suicide, you must take the pill yourself, that the checks and balances aren't as secure as they perhaps thought, that there are proxy votes and how this is done. So there may be, I'm not against the debate. Gavin and I are having a debate. I'm always up for a debate and a conversation. But there are a lot of pressing issues that are filling the Assembly's time right now. And I think this has already given an indication, only one MP in favour. This wouldn't probably be a wise thing to bring before our Assembly, because it's not going to pass at this moment.
Peter Lynas, thank you. Gavin Walker, thank you. Sorry we've run out of time, but thank you again, because when we bring you on, you debate the points, you debate them with passion, but you do it in a dignified way. It is a very heavy subject. Thank you to Peter Lynas. Thank you to Gavin Walker. So, for the last 4 minutes, we need cheered up. No better way to be cheered up than talking about I'm a Celebrity. Dean has gone. Dean McCulloch has gone. Barry McGuigan is hanging on. Now, Dean throughout the series had been getting plenty of screen time after facing 6 Bush-Tucker trials in a row. But last week, and this may have been significant, tensions rose after he was criticised for not doing his job properly of collecting water.
I can't. It's not for me. Do.
Dean, Melvin's calling you.
Yes,
we're
Mel.
All right to boil just a little pot, you know, and then let's do double up and we're done.
Got it.
Yeah?
Look at us. We're shells of our former selves. Also, I did washing up for 3 days.
Wow, 3 days.
Well, actually, it was maybe four. I did, Colleen.
You
were
there,
me, you and TK. We were the washing up gals.
For 4 days.
Or was it five?
Rubbish.
That's what we need.
Yeah.
So Dean was controversial. He wasn't everyone's cup of tea. I'm sure he's enjoying a cup of tea now. Sunday Life showbiz columnist and I'm a Celeb superfan, Kelly Allen. There's a superfan and there's a superfan, Kelly, but you love this show. My goodness, were you surprised to see Dean go out last night?
I was surprised he wasn't out first, to be honest. I think he did well. Do you know what? I know Dean. I really like Dean. But you know what? I think he really tried to play a tactful game, and it didn't work, to be honest. I thought it was very entertaining to watch, but I think the thing is, with I'm a Celebrity, you kind of need to go under the radar and then come into your own in the last week. And he certainly didn't do that.
He said afterwards, "Oh, I've made best of friends in there." Really?
I don't know. I mean, I'd say they always say they all keep in touch. And actually, I was watching a thing the other night with Sam Thompson, and he says they still have a WhatsApp group. I think he won it last year. So you never know. He might hang on to some people. I'm not sure Colleen and Wayne are going to be having a lounge for Christmas. Let's put it that way.
And they say there's no such thing as bad publicity. Has this turbo boosted his career, do you think?
Yeah, I would say so. Because, I mean, he's quite a big deal on Radio 1. But outside of that, you know, probably people in their sort of 40s, 50s, 60s might not know who he is. And now they certainly will, because it's an older demographic that watches The Jungle. So I think it will certainly have raised his profile, which, you know, I don't think it's going to do him any harm. Let's put it that way.
And how do you think Barry McGuigan's going to get on?
I think Barry McGuigan can go all the way. He's been really good in there. You know, he did a challenge last night, and he was really sort of, he wanted to do as well as everybody else and bring home the meals. He's obviously struggling with his eyesight, so God love him. He had to throw balls into a hole, and he couldn't even see where they were going. But I think everyone likes him. He's sort of the dad of camp, isn't he?
And I'm not a super fan, Kelly. Remind me when it all comes to an end.
Well, we don't actually get completely told, but I think it's probably got about another week and a half to go.
And who's your money on?
I think Danny Jones will bring it home. Do not underestimate McFly fan.
My goodness, my goodness. Kelly Allen, thank you very much indeed. We'll have the very latest on I'm a Celebrity tomorrow. Also the very latest on the Boyne Bridge. Let's see what happens at Belfast City Council tonight. They're meeting for the final time in 2024. It's December, folks. Who can believe it? It's cold outside. But I know who's going to warm you up. He's coming up next. Connor Phillips.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.